most expensive sandbox he had ever played with, all set up to let him discover wonderful new things. I still remember his glee when he told me about his latest work. "Releasing factors, Stuart. We have discovered releasing factors." His joy was as pure as that of a kid showing off a beautiful shell picked up at the seashore. Their play was esoteric and difficult to understand for most people, but activity and the joy were the same as they would be for a kid in a sandbox. For Salk and other scientists I talked to, the thrill of their play was amplified because their particular sandboxes were filled with expensive toys, and the implications of their research were so profound. It wasn't just Mom applauding about a well-built sandcastle. It was about making a difference in the world, as well as being on the cover of Time magazine and receiving a medal from the King of Sweden. Work that is actually play can be found at a much less lofty level, too. I once met someone who said the best job he ever had was working in his family's auto junkyard. He said that he and his brother would compete to see who could sort through a stack of used carburetors fastest, or break down and rebuild generators. They got a lot of work done, but it was also great fun. The work that we find most fulfilling is almost always a recreation and extension of youthful play. The engineers that JPL found to be so adept were the ones who had played with their hands in their youth, taking apart clocks and cameras, building forts and stereos. They performed well as adult engineers not because they had lots of practice working on watches, but because, in a sense, they were doing for work what they had always done for pure enjoyment. They were still playing. A recent cover of the New Yorker magazine captured this playful aspect of engineering for me. It showed a guy high above New York on a skyscraper under construction, sitting on one bare I-beam and drawing the next one, creating the building by drawing it. It brought to mind the famous children's book Harold in the Purple Crayon, about a boy who creates his own world and gets in and out of scrapes by drawing purple lines on the blank book pages. The guy on the New Yorker cover even looked like a grown-up version of Harold, now inventing his own world on an adult scale. I think that for architects and engineers who are really good at what they do and enjoy their work, there is always a strong echo of the enjoyment they got as they designed and built things in their childhood. What is your play personality? As we grow older, we start to have strong preferences for certain types of play over others. Some things float your boat, others don't. Over the years, I've observed that people have a dominant mode of play that falls into one of eight types. I call these play personalities. These categories are not scientifically based, but I've found them to be generally accurate. No one is a perfect example of a single play personality type. Most of us are a mix of these categories. At different times and in different situations, people might find themselves playing in a mode that is different than their dominant type. I've found that most people recognize themselves in these archetypes and find them useful for discovering their own play personality. This chapter will discuss the types of play personalities and then offer listeners a chance to identify their own type as a way to achieve greater self-awareness and greater play in life. The eight personality types are the Joker. The most basic and extreme player throughout history is the Joker. A Joker's play always revolves around some kind of nonsense. Indeed, nonsense is the first type of human play we engage in. All baby talk begins with nonsense. Parents make infants laugh by making silly sounds, blowing raspberries, and generally being foolish. Later, the class clown finds social acceptance by making other people laugh. Adult jokers carry on that social strategy, though. George Clooney is a notorious practical joker. On the set of Ocean's 12 and Ocean's 13, he and fellow actor Matt Damon reportedly would try to outdo each other with practical jokes. My dentist, John Lauer, also qualifies for this designation. As the dental chair reclines, his patients see a large ceiling sign that says, "The dentist tells the jokes," and inevitably, he has a new one on the tip of his tongue. The kinesthete. Kinesthetes are people who like to move, who, in the words of Sir Ken Robinson, need to move in order to think. This category includes athletes, but also others like Gillian Lynn, who find themselves happiest moving as part of dance, swimming, or walking. Kinesthetes naturally want to push their bodies and feel the result. They may be those who do football, yoga, dance, or jump rope. While kinesthetes may play games, competition is not the main focus. It is only a forum for engaging in their favorite activity. A friend of mine has a daughter who is a gifted young gymnast. Her academic parents became concerned over the difficulties she had in reading comprehension. Her mother, however, noticed that she could concentrate on tasks when she was bouncing on a large inflated ball. So her mother began to have reading lessons with her as she sat, moving on the ball. The daughter's reading ability and skill at retaining information has been improving consistently. She will likely never choose to become a librarian, but her sense of failure at reading has vanished. The Explorer. Each of us started our lives by exploring the world around us. Some people never lose their enthusiasm for it. Exploration becomes their preferred avenue into the alternative universe of play, their way of remaining creative and provoking the imagination. Think Richard Branson or Jane Goodall. Exploring can be physical, literally going to new places. Alternatively, it can be emotional, searching for a new feeling or deepening of the familiar through music, movement, flirtation. It can be mental, researching a new subject or discovering new experiences and points of view while remaining in your armchair. The Competitor. The competitor is a person who breaks through into the euphoria and creativity of play by enjoying a competitive game with specific rules and enjoys playing to win. He's the Terminator. She's the Dominator. The competitor loves fighting to be number one. If games and keeping score are your thing, this may be your primary play personality. The game can be solitary or social, either a solitary video game or a team game like baseball, and they may be actively participated in or observed as a fan. Competitors make themselves known in social groups when the fun comes from being the top person in the group, or in business in which money or perks serve to keep score. The Director. Directors enjoy planning and executing scenes and events. Though many are unconscious of their motives and style of operating, they love the power, even when they're playing in the B-movie league. They are born organizers. At their best, they are the party givers, the instigators of great excursions to the beach, the dynamic center of the social world. At worst, they are manipulators. All the world's a stage, and the rest of us are only players in the director's game. Good examples in this category are barefoot Contessa chef Ina Garten and Oprah Winfrey. The Collector. What good is a world of random objects? The thrill of play for the collector is to have and to hold the most, the best, the most interesting collection of objects or experiences. Coins, toy trains, antiques, plastic purses, wine, shoes, ties, video clips of race car crashes, or pieces of the crashed cars themselves, anything and everything is fair game for the collector. One person I know travels the world to see solar eclipses, which might seem like the action of an explorer, except that he has to see every single one and methodically collects evidence of each eclipse. Collectors may enjoy collecting as a solitary activity, or they may find it the focus of an intense social connection with others who have similar obsessions. Jay Leno is famous for his car collection. Collecting cars and working on them is what he does in his free time to play. The Artist Creator. For the artist creator, joy is found in making things. Painting, printmaking, woodworking, pottery, and sculpture are well-known activities of artist creators. But furniture making, knitting, sewing, and gardening are also in their purview. Artist creators may end up showing their creations to the world and even selling them for millions, or may never show anyone what they make. The point is to make something beautiful, something functional, something goofy, or just to make something work. The artist creator may be someone who enjoys taking apart a pump, replacing broken parts, cleaning it, and putting back together a shiny, perfectly working mechanism, in effect, making it anew. It may mean decorating a room or a house. British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher enjoyed wallpapering in her free time. Matisse experimented with many different forms of fine art in his career, from oil paints and pastels to paper cutouts and stained glass windows. The Storyteller. For the storyteller, the imagination is the key to the kingdom of play. Storytellers are, of course, novelists, playwrights, cartoonists, and screenwriters, but they are also those whose greatest joy is reading those novels and watching those movies, people who make themselves part of the story, who experience the thoughts and emotions of characters in the story. Performers of all sorts are storytellers, creating an imaginative world through dance, acting, magic tricks, or lectures. Because the realm of the storyteller is in the imagination, they can bring play to almost any activity. They may be playing a recreational game of tennis, but in their mind, each point is part of an exciting drama. The pressure is really on Roger Federer now. He really has to make this point to save the set. In contrast to the competitor, the storyteller's main point of the game is to have an exciting match. Even cooking macaroni and cheese can be transformed through imagination into a worldwide telecast celebrity cook-off. Garrison Keillor and Bob Costas are two examples of natural-born storytellers. The Fate of the Sea Squirt. If we let the play drive express itself well into adulthood, as we are built to do, we find opportunities to play everywhere. The brain keeps developing, adapting, learning about the world, and finding new ways to enjoy it. Many studies have demonstrated that people who continue to play games, who continue to explore and learn throughout life, are not only much less prone to dementia and other neurological problems, but are also less likely to get heart disease and other afflictions that seem like they have nothing to do with the brain. For instance, various studies have shown that only a small part of the risk of getting Alzheimer's disease is determined by genes. The majority of the risk of Alzheimer's is attributed to lifestyle and environmental influences. One prospective study done at Albert Einstein and Syracuse universities showed that for people who had the most cognitive activity, doing puzzles, reading, engaging in mentally challenging work, the chances of getting Alzheimer's disease were 63% lower than that of the general population. If we stop playing, we share the fate of all animals that grow out of play. Our behavior becomes fixed. We are not interested in new and different things. We find fewer opportunities to take pleasure in the world around us. From time to time, I run into people I grew up with, and like many people, I take note of how the years have treated them. As the decades go by, the differences in vitality really show. Everyone notices when a friend's hair turns gray in their 40s, and wrinkles really start to accumulate in the 50s, but the friend usually has the same personality and is just as sharp as ever mentally. But I've noticed that the brain really begins to change in the 60s and 70s, and some people start to lose the intellectual sharpness they had before. The people who stay sharp and interesting are the ones who continue to play and work. I have many examples from play histories and my own experience, and I bet you also know a few older people who are interesting because they are still funny and playful. For example, my friend Alan spent his professionally focused years as a successful pediatric oncologist. He enjoyed a consistent sense that his creativity and compassion offered him a wonderfully rewarding but demanding life. As retirement loomed, he knew he felt vital when he worked with his hands, but he doubted his talents. He began to sculpt wood from large samples scrounged from Northern California beaches after winter storms. He is now well into his 80s, has a remarkable sculpture garden, and also a wonderful vegetable garden, and spends his days in play. Most of his sculptures depict the indomitable spirit of those kids he treated who inspired him while undergoing chemotherapy or radiation therapy. He tells me he feels sharper and energized by each new sculpture, and his encyclopedic knowledge of gardening, gleaned since he was 65, feeds his spirit and our need for exotic veggies. A study done in Okinawa, Japan by the National Geographic Society revealed that engaging in activities like playing with young children was as important as diet and exercise in fostering the Okinawans' legendary longevity. I remember one particular guy from my own trip there, a woodcarver who was reputed to be close to 100. Through a translator, he told me that he laughed all the time as he was carving. I bought a small wooden Buddha from him and asked him what was the longest time he spent on one carving. 2 years, he said, and laughed. When we stop playing, we stop developing. And when that happens, the laws of entropy take over. Things fall apart. Ultimately, we share the fate of the sea squirt and become vegetative, staying in one spot, not fully interacting with the world, more plant than animal. When we stop playing, we start dying. Part 2. Living the Playful Life. Chapter 4. Parenthood is Child's Play. Little Leo is a cherub. At 18 months, he is bursting with glee and laughter. He clearly and exuberantly loves who he is. His true feelings are written in his every move, unmistakable in his body actions, voice, and expressions. He is fully here, and the contagion of his joy sweeps his parents and all those he meets into a shared state of rapture. Watching him, I feel that this is as good as it gets. Leo is natural. He is real. While playing together, he and I form a unit that feels fully alive. Watching Leo at a local childcare center and hearing the peals of laughter from the caretakers as they encourage his playful idiosyncrasies, I wonder, what is he up to? At this age, he loves to push chairs around, move them all over the room. He rearranges those already in place at a children's table, runs them around the room, squealing as he goes, and with his usual intense and happy engrossment. He continues this for a few minutes, then beams and takes a seat at the table, after which he is through. Like most kids his age, he thrives on repetition and ritual, but this is his very own playful quirk. It demonstrates, I believe, a core inbuilt play nature, which will, if left unfettered, gradually morph into his play personality. The happy director? Where does this exuberance come from, and where does it go? At some point in life, many of us lose it. We grow out of childhood and leave behind childish things. We feel that we shouldn't act this way anymore, and get a sort of willful amnesia for pure play experiences. Seeing a child like Leo reminds us of the joy we may be leaving behind. I talk a lot about play in children, but it's interesting to me that the focus of the conversation often comes back to play in their parents. Recently, just after I finished a talk at the New York Public Library, a woman came up to speak to me. She smiled, but behind the smile there seemed to be some tightly wound emotions. She said that I had convinced her that play is important, and said she worried about her kids, 10 and 12 years old, getting enough time to play, but still studying and working enough that they would be successful in life. We spoke about the nature of success, and she realized that what she was really talking about was teaching them how to become responsible adults who have a playful approach to life, who enjoy life, and have work that excites them. It soon became clear to me that this was something that was missing in her own life. Like many parents, she wanted to give her kids something she didn't have. This woman was enormously successful, a partner at a major New York law firm. She had done all the right things and gone to all the right schools. But now she sheepishly admitted that she was not all that happy, as if this were a shameful secret. And now she was getting her kids into all the right schools and all the right activities, but she worried she was taking them down the path that she had tread. Conversations about play and kids also go in the other direction. When I do workshops for corporations, the emphasis is on improving employee innovation and collaboration by understanding play. But people often come back and report that the very first effect of my presentation has been to improve how they interact with their kids. In the end, I get the sense that adults feel that they themselves didn't get it right, that they once had something special and let it go. They don't know where it went or how to get it back, but they do want to give their children more options than they had. In some ways, the threat to play is even greater than it was a generation or more ago. Parents who had the experience, as I did, of exploring fields or woods in freedom worry that kids today are spending too much of their time on video games or in safe activities. Some people have noted the brisk sales of The Dangerous Book for Boys, which promotes the kind of rough-and-tumble, exciting, and slightly risky games and activities that used to be so common before video games and the parentally organized, high-expectation trip to the soccer field at age 6 became the norm. Schools have evolved into assembly lines for high test scores, where skills are drilled, supposedly all the better to prepare kids for college. In many ways, these developments give kids a more privileged, more sophisticated view of life. And yet we have the feeling that something is lost, perhaps unfettered imagination and freedom. This chapter is nominally about play in children, but really is about play in all of us. Childhood is where it all begins, the time of life when play comes naturally. It is the foundation of what we do for the rest of our lives. As we understand the unique play patterns of childhood, we can start to see our child's own truth and purpose, and we can begin to visualize a path that will lead to happiness and fulfillment. Yet helping them along that path requires that we remember the emotional states of play in our own childhood, which provide clues to the primal state of playful bliss for each of us. On commercial airplanes, the instructions for emergency procedures tell adults that in the event of cabin depressurization, they should put on their own oxygen mask before they assist children. Likewise, in order to help our children, we have to recover memories of how we once played, by retracing our own early play footprints. When we do that and create a playful household, everything from education to chores will go better. Here are the footprints of play, the baby steps we take from the most basic to complex play behavior, and what they do for us. Play at the beginning of life. Play actually begins to have an effect on a child even before birth, at least indirectly. Unlike most animals, humans spend 3/4 of a year in the womb, emerging at birth as a virtually helpless fetal being. During gestation, the embryo and developing fetus are subject to strong prenatal influences, from the nutrition to the stress levels of the mother. Even in utero, neural circuits are taking shape, circuits that will set brain patterns for the rest of our lives. An expectant mother's play can lower her stress levels and help lessen the discomforts of pregnancy. But that playfulness can also help preform the mindset of the baby inside her. The effects of the prenatal environment can even be multi-generational. As amazing as it seems, studies of the Dutch hunger winter during World War II demonstrate that your IQ, your risk of heart disease, and other health problems are influenced by how well your grandmother ate during the third trimester of her pregnancy with your mother. Researchers have also shown that fetal movements, the kicking, punching, or writhing, can also be thought of as an expression of a play program. These seemingly random motions are generated by the central nervous system as a way of making working connections between the limbs and the brain. Once the baby is born, the seemingly random play behaviors will help him explore the world. Attunement. At 3 or 4 months of age, if a child is well-fed and safe, and a mother's emotional state is one of openness and calm, when parents and child make eye contact, they initiate a harmonic meeting of the minds. As they gaze into each other's eyes, the baby will radiate a compelling smile, and the mother will automatically respond with a surge of emotion and verbal and bodily joyfulness, and smile back. He will make little sounds, a babble, or a light laughter, and she will respond in a rhythmic sing-song voice. This is universal across all cultures around the globe. What's going on in the brain is even more amazing. As they lock eyes, both mother and child are synchronizing the neural activity in the right cortex of each brain. If we wired mom and baby and took an electroencephalogram, EEG, you would see their brain currents are actually in sync. This is called attunement. Their brain rhythms are getting in tune, performing a kind of mind meld that is a very pure form of intimacy. Fathers, too, experience this as they engage with babies. But traditionally, this occurs most between mother and child. When attunement occurs, both parent and baby experience a joyful union. My observation, as I've said, is that this experience is the most basic state of play, and that it becomes a foundation for the much more complex states of play that we engage in throughout life. Alan Shore, a UCLA researcher who has been a pioneer in integrating social, biological, and psychoanalytical theory, has discovered that attunement, also called bonding, is critical for later emotional self-regulation. Abused children who never adequately experience this end up being extremely emotionally brittle and behave erratically. The implications of Shore's research and its correlation with other related long-term research on human development are just now receiving the attention they deserve. For example, the child who does not experience attunement because of deprivation or abuse has difficulty forming healthy attachments. This has implications for later adult capacities for stress management, and likely affects the efficient working of the emotional regulatory tasks that are generally believed to reside in the right, non-dominant, prefrontal cortex. The right and left prefrontal cortices lie in front of the motor centers, and are active in integrating cognitive and executive decision-making. The right side develops more rapidly than the left, is more vulnerable to early deprivational damage, and is felt to be essential to later emotional regulatory activities, risk-taking decisions, and social judgments. If we assume that the neurophysiological models of animal play apply to us, then attunement, the base state of play, buffers the growing infant and child against excessive surges of emotion. It also helps orchestrate the symphony of genetic signals that govern optimal brain development during childhood, adolescence, and young adulthood. Body and movement play. Infants begin to play to make sense of their bodies very early. As I've mentioned, this play program really starts in the womb. Once they are born, the urge to squirm and wave arms continues, and as soon as they can get up on their hands and knees at 3 to 9 months, they learn to rock and then crawl. They stick things in their mouths and gnaw with their gums. They roll food around with their tongues, sucking it in and spitting it out, enjoying the process immensely. Later, with spoon in hand, they may catapult or fling a glob of food across the room. These are not random movements. They are intrinsic behaviors that promote exploration and learning. Babbling becomes intelligible words. Babies who are born hearing impaired will actually use play movements to learn to communicate physically, first babbling with simple symmetric movements, which slowly become simple sign language when an adult signs back consistently. Movement is primal and accompanies all the elements of play we are examining, even word or image movement in imaginative play. If you don't understand and appreciate human movement, you won't really understand yourself or play. Learning about self-movement creates a structure for an individual's knowledge of the world. It is a way of knowing. Through movement play, we think in motion. Movement structures our knowledge of the world, space, time, and our relationship to others. We've internalized movement, space, and time so completely that we need to take a step back, a movement metaphor, to realize how much we think in these terms. Our knowledge of the physical world, based in movement, explains why we describe emotions with terms like close, distant, open, closed. We say we grasp ideas, or wrestle with them, or stumble upon them. Movement play lights up the brain and fosters learning, innovation, flexibility, adaptability, and resilience. These central aspects of human nature require movement to be fully realized. This is why, when someone is having a hard time getting into a play state, I have them do something that involves movement, because body play is universal. As Bob Fagan says, movement fills an empty heart. The play-driven pleasures associated with exploratory body movements, rhythmic early speech, moving vocal cords, locomotor and rotational activity are done for their own sake. They are pleasurable and intrinsically playful, yet they also help sculpt the brain. One of John Byers' studies of antelopes and other animals revealed that the periods of greatest play were also the time of most rapid growth of the area of the brain known as the cerebellum. If the antelope's activity is inhibited during this period, the growth of nerve cells in the cerebellum is greatly reduced. It has been theorized that the fueling of many areas of the developing brain is enhanced by cerebellar stimulation. While this is a big jump, not yet fully validated by research, it is not illogical. As mentioned earlier, cerebellar functions are now being reappraised by the neuroscience research community. The accumulating evidence confirms that the cerebellum is continuously making contributions, particularly during periods of maximum development, to motor dexterity and to mental dexterity in humans, both of which are required for the emergence of fluent human language. Object play. Curiosity about and manipulation of objects is a pervasive, innately fun pattern of play and represents its own state, intrinsic pattern, of playfulness. Early on, spoons, teething rings, or foods become objects of play. After a toddler is age 15 months or so, his or her toys take on highly personalized characteristics. As skills in manipulating objects, example, banging on pans, skipping rocks, develop, the richer the circuits in the brain become. We find pleasure in the physical part of object play, in putting together a puzzle, kicking a ball through the goal, or simply tossing a paper wad in the wastebasket. And as lab managers at JPL discovered, object play with the hands creates a brain that is better suited for understanding and solving problems of all sorts. Imaginative play. Imagination is perhaps the most powerful human ability. It allows us to create simulated realities that we can explore without giving up access to the real world. The earliest evidence of imaginative play comes at about the age of 2 in the form of fragmentary stories. Play scholar Brian Sutton Smith describes these early attempts as partial narratives based on silliness or nonsense without all the elements of a story, beginning, middle, and end. Then, with development, kids acquire the capacity to create a coherent narrative. The imperative to create narrative occurs worldwide in children and is an integral aspect of their play. But whatever the age level or degree of completeness of the story, there is a gleeful verbal experience as the storymaker spins out the storyline. After this, children engage in imaginative play often, naturally and energetically moving freely back and forth between reality and pretend. Determining what is pretend and what is real is usually more important to the adults listening or watching than to the child engaged in make-believe adventures. As kids grow older, the line between what is pretend and what is real becomes more solid, but imaginative play continues to nourish the spirit. As I've discussed already, a close examination of adult stream of consciousness demonstrates that the pretend-real process is a lifelong aspect of human thought. We continually make up storylines in our heads to keep the past, present, and future in context. Since kids are embarking hourly on a new life adventure, they use their imaginative urges to keep a context for the emotional and cognitive symphony that is their developing being. Throughout life, imagination remains a key to emotional resilience and creativity. Deprivation studies demonstrate that fantasizing, imagining the inner life of others and comparing it to one's own, is one of the keys to developing empathy, understanding, and trust of others, as well as personal coping skills. Social play. From the simplest game of peekaboo to a formal dance ball, social play has a major role in human play behavior. Humans are social animals, and play is the gas that drives the engine of social competence. Play allows society to function and individual relationships among many to flourish. Here are a few identifiable subtypes of social play: friendship and belonging, rough-and-tumble play, and celebratory and ritual play. Friendship and belonging. As I noted before, kids begin social play with other kids first through parallel play. Two kids may sit next to each other, both playing with sand, water, crayons, or blocks, and cognizant of each other's presence, but not interacting directly or emotionally with each other. This type of play serves as a bridge to more cooperative play. Kids playing in parallel are in position to start reaching out to their play neighbor and become part of their game. By the time they are 4 to 6 years old, mutual play becomes the crucible in which empathy for others is refined. As they suggest their own imaginative elements in their game, kids hear other contributions and come to understand other points of view. This mutual play is the basic state of friendship that operates throughout our lives. Give and take, with shared contagious enthusiasm, characterizes healthy mutual play. Rough and tumble play. Research on rough-and-tumble play in animals and humans has shown that it is necessary for the development and maintenance of social awareness, cooperation, fairness, and altruism. Its nature and importance are generally unappreciated, particularly by preschool teachers or anxious parents, who often see normal rough-and-tumble play behavior, such as hitting, diving, and wrestling, all done with a smile between friends who stay friends, not as a state of play, but a state of anarchy that must be controlled. Lack of experience with rough-and-tumble play hampers the normal give-and-take necessary for social mastery and has been linked to poor control of violent impulses in later life. While studying the young murderers in Texas many years ago, we found an absence of rough-and-tumble play in their early backgrounds when compared to similar non-murderers we interviewed as controls in our study. Since then, the animal experiments with rat rough-and-tumble play, Anthony Pellegrini's extensive study on playground play, Joe Frost's 38 years of observations on playground play, and my own examination of this form of play through many clinical reviews have all supported the importance of this sort of play. Pellegrini has shown that rough-and-tumble play varies with age. His studies demonstrate that early activities such as chases may relate to later social problem solving, while the aggressive exploitation that commonly occurs later helps resolve dominance and competitiveness issues. Joe Frost is a professor emeritus in education at the University of Texas. His observations are more across the board and have resulted in his active participation in playground design features that foster play from early preschool through age 12. For more than 38 years at the Redeemer School in Austin, he has been innovative in organizing a large playground with multiple free play environments. From watching and creating these playground opportunities, he sees that there are many lifelong benefits derived in playground settings. He offers young children environments that foster graduated exploratory play, with areas that incite vigorous free play and spontaneous games, so that light-supervised rough-and-tumble play and spontaneous games are fully experienced. He has also established a verdant playground adjacent to the more traditional one, an area with trees and native plants where solitary play occurs. While his observations are impressionistic, they are based on symptomatic long-term observations with informal follow-up. Frost has strong opinions about the value of rough-and-tumble play to provide a necessary and important base for successful cooperative socialization. In Frost's mind, rough-and-tumble play is generally defined as friendly or play-fighting and may be extended more broadly to any active play that includes body contact among children. In practice, the meaning is also extended to superhero play, typically influenced by television characters. Children in school assume roles of good guys and bad guys and play out themes in such games as tag, chase, King of the Mountain, and mock karate. From its beginnings in infancy, rough-and-tumble play is integrative in nature, initially including preliminary symbolic play and organized games, over time expanding into more sophisticated versions, and with experience and development taking on characteristics of organized sports. Many adults, including teachers, do not distinguish between play fighting and real aggression, and prohibit any form of wrestling, shouting, and make-believe aggression, Frost observes. However, children know the difference between friendly and real aggression, and, when allowed, engage in rough-and-tumble play very actively, changing the nature of the game to accommodate interest and/or demands by a self-appointed leader. Outright physical rough-and-tumble play diminishes with age, but a lifelong involvement in games, sports, and group activities that not only tolerate but foster creative tension is a natural extension of this type of play. Celebratory and ritual play. Children don't need formal events to initiate play, because they do so naturally. But it is important to mention celebratory and ritual play as one of the types of social play. Celebratory and ritual play may be a birthday celebration, a dance, a holiday dinner, or a seventh-inning round of take me out to the ball game. Children don't spontaneously initiate these events, but such ritual social experiences create a reservoir of good memories to help them develop a taste for ritual play as adults. Serious adult rituals often are accompanied by celebratory play, like the reception after a wedding. In adults, rituals and celebration is often necessary both to provide an official excuse to play and to keep the play pattern under social control. Storytelling and narrative play. The wind howls outside, and rain pelts the roof. The little girl's mother said she would be gone for only a few minutes, but now hours have gone by and the night is black as a dungeon. The lights flicker, then snuff out, and she hears a horrible moaning from the basements. Storytelling has been identified as the unit of human understanding. It occupies a central place in early development and learning about the world, oneself, and one's place in it. A critical function of the dominant left hemisphere of the brain is to continuously make up stories about why things are the way they are, which becomes our understanding of the world. Stories are a way of putting disparate pieces of information into a unified context. As we grow, the drama of stories enliven us, and the narrative structure tells us something about how things are and how things should be, whether we are listening to Big Bird's take on life or Garrison Keillor's Tales of Lake Wobegon. Stories remain central to understanding well after childhood. When people make judgments about right and wrong, even in politics or the jury box, they often do so as a result of a story that they construct about events that have happened. You may have even noticed, as you listen to this book, that stories about research or play situations are much more engaging and feel more informative about the science of play than some of the straight science. It's just human nature. Storytelling has the capacity to produce a sense of timelessness, pleasure, and an altered state of vicarious involvement that identifies narrative and storytelling with states of play. Transformative, integrative, and creative play. Play can become a doorway to a new self, one much more in tune with the world. Because play is all about trying on new behaviors and thoughts, it frees us from established patterns. For children, who are always in the process of changing and becoming, transformative play is a constant part of their world, and often goes unnoticed. Sometimes, though, in kids who are really stuck, play can provide a dramatic and obvious example of transformation. In the process of completing the PBS film series, The Promise of Play, our crew was allowed to follow the progress of a 9-year-old girl who had been identified as depressed, friendless, and playless. At her school, time was set aside for her to work with a group called Positive Intervention Through Play, which was orchestrated by a teacher trained as a play therapist. We observed and filmed the girl over a 4-month period as she began to tap into basic play modes, dance, play with toys in a dollhouse setting, and so on. Her isolative and inappropriate social behavior began to change, and her mood lightened. At the last filming, the crew was in tears as she exuberantly and freely played on the playground with friends who had previously shunned her for her bizarre, non-playful behavior, and was affectionate with her teachers. Her actual engagement in play, not the coaching of her teacher, had transformed her. Through play, her internal narratives had changed from sterile and sad to rich and imaginative. When we engage in fantasy play at any age, we bend the reality of our ordinary lives, and in the process, germinate new ideas and ways of being. For adults, daydreams may give rise to new ways of doing business. Fantasies may lead to new love. Visualization may lead to a remodeled house or a new invention. Creative play takes our minds to places we have never been, pioneering new paths that the real world can follow. Like when Einstein came up with his theory of relativity after imagining himself riding on a streetcar traveling at the speed of light. Or like when a lighthearted group of designers from the IDEO Corporation wildly imagine all the ways they can create an indoor dog exercising machine. In each case, they are using their playfulness to innovate and create. In a healthy household, these play stages will emerge naturally, bubbling up from inside the child. Parents who provide a loving, safe atmosphere and model playfulness will allow the play drive to express itself. If these elements are not present, children may miss one or more pieces of the natural modes of play. I had the disturbing but enlightening duty of documenting this firsthand. The Life and Death of Charles Whitman. My first real scientific study of play came in the form of a gun-laden student and what was, until the massacre at Virginia Tech in 2007, the worst episode of mass murder ever on a college campus. On a hot Texas morning in August 1966, an architectural engineering student named Charles Whitman climbed the campus tower at the University of Texas in Austin and started shooting the people below. His first victim was a pregnant woman. With deadly accurate fire, he killed 15 and wounded 31 before being gunned down by a courageous citizen and an off-duty police officer. Police would find out later that the night before, Whitman had killed his wife and mother. At the time, I was a newly minted assistant professor of psychiatry at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Shortly after the shooting, I received a call from the chairman of the Baylor Department of Psychiatry, who was at a conference in Spain. He was calling me because the governor of Texas had contacted him. Governor Connally himself had been shot and narrowly escaped death during the Kennedy assassination. Now he was worried that there were Oswalds and Whitmans lurking on every street corner. Connally had demanded an immediate investigation to discover why Whitman had done this and how he could identify people like Whitman before they struck. Connally authorized the use of all funds and resources necessary, including the governor's plane, to find answers. The department chairman asked me to take charge of the psychiatric component of the investigation, which was arguably the most important part. Most of the immediate speculations, mine included, were that a ravingly deranged paranoid maniac was responsible, but when the shooter was identified, there was shock. Whitman was seemingly a loving husband and son. An ex-Marine, he had been the youngest Eagle Scout in the history of the Boy Scouts. Peering deeper, however, we found Whitman's true nature and how he got that way. When the small army of Blue Ribbon Committee members met after their exploratory work was done, the expectation was that each discipline, whether toxicology, neurology, neuropathology, graphology, sociology, psychology, and psychiatry, or law enforcement, would have a particular point of view to propound. Yet we came to a unanimous conclusion. What was not surprising to most of us was that, over-controlled by Charlie's father and the unending abuse directed at Charlie's mother, had been major factors in the development of behavioral problems that ultimately led to what became known in the media as the Texas Tower Massacre. But the incredibly thorough investigation of Charlie's whole life revealed a more surprising factor. After extensive interviews with everyone who had entered Charlie's life, it became clear that the lifelong lack of play had itself been an important factor in his psychopathology. How did this lack of play have a direct role in his ongoing troubles and his homicidal breakdown? At many junctures in Charlie's life, he could not see outside the box that his father had placed him in. The multiple options found in a free-flowing imagination, which occur spontaneously in a naturally playful, safely nurtured childhood, were not available. The open exchanges that begin in preschool parallel play, the broadening spectrum of give-and-take offered in pickup games, and the variety of choices that more intricate play provides were not his to experience. In Charlie's home, the constant mantle of control and fear didn't allow the emergence of normal patterns of play. Charlie wasn't allowed to play outside with other kids. Instead, he was forced to stay inside and do something useful, like practice piano. When Charlie did get away from his father, when he was out with his mother at the grocery store, his father was still there controlling events by CB radio. When friends of the family did come over, the first thing the elder Whitman would do was put Charlie on display, demanding an impromptu piano recital or showing off some other trick he had taught Charlie. The result was that nothing Charlie did came from within himself. I interviewed his nursery school teachers, who remarked that even when he was young, Charlie could not really play freely. He would watch what other kids were doing and imitate them, but he wasn't really ever in it. The parish priest told me that Whitman didn't get what confession was about because Charlie couldn't talk about what he felt bad about doing. He could only talk about what he thought he was expected to feel bad about. As Charlie matured, his repertoire of responses to the world was narrow, kept within the boundaries of his father's ambitions for him, and closely monitored. A master of outward conformity, he was inwardly seething for years. He sought out no real mentors to break his father's control, so that by the time of the Texas Tower Massacre, he lived emotionally alone, persevering on a path he could not master, driven not by his own desires or needs, and without alternatives. His final, and only, really autonomous action, narrow in scope but devastating in effect, was an attempt to gain some inner relief by acts of murder-suicide, well described in his diaries. Charlie is obviously an extreme example of parental overcontrol. In most cases, kids left to their own devices will play naturally, and there is some kind of parental supervision necessary to make kids feel safe and protected. Allowing kids to play also doesn't mean that there is no structure to their time. Part of the license to play freely comes from being in an environment that is structured enough to provide a feeling of safety